Good morning. Hawaii teachers can now travel with their students without fear of violating ethics laws. Hawaii State Teachers Association President Corey Rosenly looks at that controversy. And controversy, the lawsuit, and 10 months it took to put it to rest. Controversy is no stranger in the Office of Hawaiian Affairs. Now the OHA board has voted to buy out the contract of its CEO half a year after it was renewed. New OHA board chair Rowena Akana joins us later this hour. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. The Mama Ensemble translates the experience of motherhood into the language of dance. And Aloha Got Soul takes a documentary film look at a fertile period in local music.
That's the conversation for this Thursday, January 5th. Coming up right after this news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
Some welcome news for a few people today.
Right, and some would say, should it have happened perhaps sooner? Now, it's been 10 months since the Hawaii teachers were put on notice that they could be in violation of ethics laws should they accompany students free of charge on travel trips. The State Ethics Commission opinion drew fire from the Hawaii State Teachers Association, which fought the decision and won its lawsuit to invalidate the commission's advice. This week, the commission and the HSTA announced an agreement on a policy to allow teachers to chaperone students without putting the teachers in a compromising position. HSTA President Corey Rosenly is on the line with us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Was this too much fuss for everyone instead of only the teacher involved in the original situation?
You know what? The interesting thing was there was an original situation. There was no actual complaint that was ever filed. And we're still trying to clear up the mess. But in the meantime, there have been many students that have been denied the great educational opportunity of taking trips and seeing educational opportunities beyond the classroom.
Corey, what do you mean that there really wasn't a complaint about that? Wasn't there initial, inquiry regarding the teacher at King Intermediate School?
Well, what we heard is when I was in a legislative hearing and the legislators actually asked the Ethics Commission, was there a complaint that was filed? And the Ethics Commission responded no, that there was nothing that started, there was no complaint that was filed that started this ruling, this advisory.
So how did it get to that point? Should have that been the end of it?
You'd hope so, right? And I think that the legislators were just as frustrated as the Hawaii State Teachers Association that no complaint was filed, but the advisory occurred anyway and had this devastating impact on travel.
So at this point, to have it set in crystal that, okay, as long as the teacher goes, yes, that person can be going free of charge, but as long as there are no gifts exchanged, that seemed to be the real issue with whatever perks a teacher might have received for putting together the trip. Shouldn't that have been sort of self-explanatory?
Yes, but there is something that we do need to clarify. The HSTA does have an agreement with the Ethics Commission. But after the Ethics Commission advisory occurred, the Board of Education changed its policies to match the Ethics Commission's advisory. So now that we have this agreement, we still have to go back to the Board of Education and change some of the policies that were created in order to satisfy the Ethics Commission's policy, advisory. So we still are not past clearing up all the mess that occurred, because BOE policy still does not allow students to fundraise or pay to allow for their chaperone costs. And so that's got to change.
Why didn't the DOE just wait until after the lawsuit was settled?
Because at the time, there was no lawsuit at the time. And so we were stuck in this area, and the Board of Education felt like they had to abide by the policy. In fact, the whole issue of our lawsuit was based that the Ethics Commission is not a a policy-making body, and only the Board of Education could do this. But because of the Ethics Commission's advisory, it almost forced the Board of Education to do this. So that's why we won the lawsuit, which led to our agreement that happened this week. And now we have to still go back and work with the Department of Education, the Board of Education, to fix this, and so that finally we can go back to allowing travel again for our students and our teachers.
As the BOE was quick to make its own policies in sync with what the commission had said earlier, do you hope that they will be just as quick to make it consistent with the new commission's ruling?
I hope so. In fact, we were just even yesterday trying to work with the Department of Education to look on some of the interpretation and seeing how much of this we can fix easily. I'm hoping within the next couple of months that this thing will finally be resolved. You know, it's taken almost, it's been over, you know, a year and a half now. And I know in that time, there's been two of the consequences that a lot of trips just teachers didn't even bother to start planning them. And I can't imagine how many kids have been affected by that. The second thing that's occurred, and, you know, you got to love our teachers. They don't get paid to take these students on the travel. They do it on their own free time. And then teachers, I know, have been paying out of pocket for their travel expenses so that they can take students on these travel experiences. I mean, our teachers aren't paid well to begin with, but to ask them to pay to work is an amazing thing, and teachers still have done it.
So much of this seems to come down to interpretation. In some ways, then, is it better to have gone through this process, to have gotten it out to this point where there really isn't any wiggle room?
No. This was a solution to a problem that had...
That wasn't a problem, according to you.
You know, there could have been, and everyone agrees on certain concepts, and those could have been easily put in, and no one would have had a problem with it. For example, some tour companies may suggest that you get an iPad by going to their company to travel. But we all agree that shouldn't happen. Teachers should not get rewarded for choosing a certain tour company over another tour company. But it's already so difficult for teachers to go through all the paperwork. There's an actual binder, a thick binder, of all the paperwork that they've done it. And I'll tell you, as a teacher that has gone on many field trips with my students and taken students to both Neighbor Island travel and to the mainland, it is such a difficult process that many teachers just don't even want to even start. But again, I felt it was so valuable for my students to get out of the classroom and as a history teacher to actually see historic places or visit places that could, you know, fulfill the lessons that I felt it was so valuable that I wanted to do it. And a lot of teachers make that decision. But it's not an easy process. It has to go through the administration. It has to go through the complex area superintendent. So already, even before this Ethics Commission ruling, it was still a very arduous and difficult process that had many checks and balances.
So your point was that it made a difficult situation even more so and caused a lot of kids to lose out. What's the bigger lesson from all this that you've been through over the last year or so?
You know, sometimes things need a scalpel and not a sledgehammer. Things can easily be worked out if there's a difficult situation and discussed and in order to solve that problem. And every time when we make a policy, we have to look at the impact, especially in our schools. We have 180,000 students that go to Hawaii's public schools. We have over 13,000 teachers. And, you know, a little change in a policy, a word here or there, can have devastating consequences. And so I hope when we move forward that we always look at those things.
Well, here's to scalpels and not sledgehammers. Thanks very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Corey Rosenlee is president of the Hawaii State Teachers Association. That's the union representing over 13,000 public school teachers across the state. He has taught high school social studies in Hawaii for more than 20 years. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's 8:14. Coming up, a troop of dancers that didn't let maternity slow them down. But first, here's your backyard quiz.
They say one good turn deserves another, and that's especially true in today's backyard quiz about the mating behavior of a species of tern, the seabirds that are so abundant in Hawaiian and Pacific waters. They stand out from other terns in the way they go about their courtship ritual. They bow, bob, and weave like professional boxers, making eyes at one another the whole time. Males close the deal by presenting the female with the gift of a fish. And although they're seabirds, they lack the oil glands at the base of the tail that would allow them to float for very long. They can only alight for a few minutes at a time. This morning, we're looking for the name of this seabird, well known in Hawaii, and if you can name it, call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer, and the first one to get it right will get a prize. Motherhood can derail a performing arts career if you let it. The three dancers in the Mama Ensemble chose instead to allow their pregnancy and the birth of their children to inform their art. The result is their new show, which brings together dancers from a variety of disciplines in a celebration of the event that changed their lives. Gwen Arbaugh is a founding member of the Mama Ensemble. She's with us in our studio. Good morning, Gwen.
Good morning.
And good morning, Eli, who's here with you.
Yes.
Eli is how old?
Eli's 10 months.
And when you first realized that Eli was coming along and you wanted to keep dancing, how did you deal with it?
Oh, well, I danced throughout my pregnancy. I was actually in pointe shoes 5 days before he was born. But after he was born, there's a very dramatic change in your body. And so how to keep dancing after that. It took me maybe 6 to 8 weeks to get back on my feet. It's a dramatic shift in focus as well. You're dealing with the baby.
Sure. Well, from a mechanical, you know, in terms of the mechanics of the dance, you've got a whole different, you've got a new body.
Yeah, all of my balance shifted. I had to sort of re-navigate that.
And you're traveling, training comes from ballet originally, yeah?
Originally from ballet, yeah, although I have a West African and modern dance backgrounds. And since being in Hawaii, I've been doing mostly Asian dance, Philippine dance, and Japanese classical.
Well, how did it come to your attention that there were other women in the same situation?
Well, I work in a lot of genres, and so I started to realize in all of my different areas, there were women who were also pregnant same time as me or within a year of me being pregnant. And so in the show, we have a pole dancer who is currently pregnant. So we have a pregnant pole dancer in the show. We have modern dancers. We have a ballroom dancer, a burlesque dancer, a wide variety.
Yeah. How does that integrate into a unified message? How does that all come together?
Well, using our different genres and our different training, we've all done pieces about motherhood or collaborated on pieces about motherhood.
Uh-huh.
So the whole show kind of has a chronological lead to it. We start with pregnancy, and then we go into birth. There are a couple of pieces about birth. There's a Buteau-inspired piece about birth and some monologues about birth. And then we go into family life. So we have a ballroom trio, a ballroom duo who are doing a trio with their baby, uh-huh. and a cabaret piece with babies involved on stage. And then we have some nursing segments, lactogenesis, a piece about nursing, and The Milk Diaries, which was based on our various stories of nursing. That's by Mareva Minerbi. And then we have, you know, some duets at the end with babies. So some of the time babies will be on the stage, most of the time not, because we're afraid that they'll be distracted or distressed by the audience. So
you just never know, right?
Yeah, you never know. They're unpredictable, and you can't reason with them yet. So
sometimes I wonder if you could reason with anybody. But when you were getting the show together, did you just get together and have discussions about common experiences, or how did it evolve?
Well, we started a texting thread about nursing, and then that just kept going, and people sharing different experiences and similar experiences and surprising experiences. Most of us are first-time mothers, and so there were a lot of things we didn't know were coming up. You know, it's the insider truths of motherhood is what we keep saying the show is airing for us through artistic media that we know. But we started with that, and then we started sharing stories in person in rehearsal, and we kind of made our own little performing arts baby hooey.
Yeah. What are some of those insider truths that emerged when you talked it over?
Oh, well, breastfeeding was much more intense than I ever expected. It didn't hurt, although for some women it does hurt. But there were a lot of things, you know, you stay up all night with your baby.
Yeah.
and dad doesn't necessarily have to do that. He can, but you're needed, and you know, he's kind of a substitute initially. And people are sometimes not empathetic, or they just don't know. You know, you go on a pump break at work, and people think you're playing Tetris in the bathroom. But the reality is you're topless in there with suction cups on your boobs, and it's freezing cold, and you have no hands to do anything. So it's a very, very different experience than you think from the outside.
Was that a common thread that a lot of your experiences were experiences that you hadn't anticipated, or hadn't anticipated how intense they would be?
Yeah, definitely.
So that's, you know, from those common threads, a show was born and a message is born. Makes sense, I think, to do it chronologically, yeah?
Yeah.
Onset of pregnancy. Because that's a decision point for a dancer, right? You don't do you take a break? Do you take a year hiatus, or, you know, how do you integrate it into your life as a dancer?
Yeah, in organizing the show, I really felt that I had been asked to do other projects, and my time was so inflexible, and the people on that show probably would not be able to understand that I'd be donating a very little bit of very precious time, and I wouldn't be able to be as flexible as I had been in the past, and my role probably would have been very marginalized. So I would have spent a lot of time to be very minimally involved in another project, or mm-hmm. we could make our own project. So we were all having the same sort of issue, and we got together and did a show together instead.
Well, you don't want to operate at a sort of a modified level because of your pregnancy, right?
Right. Or after the birth because you have a baby in arms. So that's another thing about this show. When we perform it next Thursday for the Fringe Festival, we will be performing without babies in arms, a lot of us, for the first time. So instead of having my baby, I'll be holding a swaddle. I'll be holding nothing in some cases. And so there'll be a level of immediacy about that. It'll be
sure.
very different.
Well, because Eli is very much just a part of how you get around these days, and he's pretty comfortable where he is right now, yeah?
Yeah, he goes with me everywhere. That's the situation. That's what it is.
Yeah. It really, it also speaks to a new approach. You know, we were talking earlier about how pregnancy was viewed back in the day, and it's very different now. That seems to be a common experience that you and the other dancers had.
Yeah, we actually have a monologue comparison in the beginning of the show with a woman who had a home birth and a woman who had a hospital birth, and we're switching back and forth between their monologues with some heartbeat in between to kind of share the contrast. And they both had some very comic experience, and they both had very long births, but there are different options today than there were in the past for birth, and people make different choices about whether to have a home birth or a hospital birth. Or
sounds as if there's a lot to be learned from this show. Thanks very much for coming in, Gwen, and Eli, for bearing with us. Thanks, Eli.
Thank you.
Gwen Arbaugh is one of the members of the MAMA Ensemble, which will perform on January 12th at the Arts at Mark's Garage in downtown Honolulu. It's part of the Oahu Fringe Festival. You can find out more about the show on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
West goes south on Twitter.
I still love Twitter. The speed of information, the breadth of analysis, but I'm leaving anyway.
Twitter legend Lindy West can take almost any insult, but should Trump and other celebrity buffaloes tolerate a home for free-roaming neo-Nazis? Home on the Strange, next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
Speculation over what happens after President-elect Trump takes office is fueling many a debate, including what impact it may have on Hawaii tourism. And that's part of the reason the Council on Revenues lowered its projection for this year. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has a reality check. Hey there, Chad.
Good morning, Bethany.
I mean, so we're told now that we should expect that there will be $155 million fewer dollars coming into the coffers. And, you know, in terms of why that may be, there are some reasons for that that are more concrete, maybe activity happening within the construction industry that might be slowing. But of looking at the idea of what might happen under President Trump seems to be where most people are letting their minds race. But in this case, we have a little bit more concrete ideas.
There was concern raised at the Council of Revenues meeting yesterday about the Trump presidency, which, of course, hasn't even begun yet. But he's very active on Twitter, very vocal about his opinions. And so this $155 million less, we're talking about the current fiscal year, the one that ends June 30th. And that may not seem like a lot of money in a budget that's $7.5 billion. But in fact, it is a lot of money because that $7.5 billion is already ready to go somewhere else. And you haven't factored in pay raises. If pay raises across the board happen at 4%, that's $250 million right there. So it is a concern. But what you heard yesterday, what Nathan Eagle said came out of the revenue, the COR, as we call them, report yesterday is, well, will Trump, as someone who has some protectionist ideas, will that harm tourism? Because tourism is our number one industry. Could it prevent or reduce or discourage people from traveling to the islands for holiday or business for that matter? So that is something that's on the minds, and that's why they've tempered that growth. They've moved it down. It was 5.5%. Now it's 3% general fund growth forecast.
Especially as, you know, we know that we've been courting other countries to come and visit Hawaii and trying to
make it
easier, make it, you know, a lot more friendly for people to come and visit us and spend their money here.
Yeah, and by the way, that does include China, which is already emerging as a rival. Ed Case, by the way, is filling in on the Council of Revenues. He's a former congressman, and he actually works for Outrigger. And that was one of the things that he raised. Carl Bonham, the economist, also said, what about trade and currency rates? Because those are issues that Donald Trump has taken a strong position on. He is for free trade, but didn't like the Trans-Pacific Partnership that's now off the table, probably. He worries about currency manipulation on the part of the Chinese government. So these are the kind of things that make you wonder whether this is going to have an impact on our own industry, or excuse me, our own economy here.
And then what happens as we see the fallout of Brexit and other countries perhaps deciding that they would prefer to have their own currency too.
Right.
We're going to talk more in future, but for the moment at least, we know what the next 6 months looks like in this way, maybe.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
We'll talk to you in the morning. Chad Blair joins us every day from Civil Beat with a reality check.
Support for today's programming comes from the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra, presenting Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone in concert, the full film with live music, 7:30 p.m. tomorrow and 2 p.m. Saturday at the Blaisdell. More at hisymphony.org.
Good morning. I'm Andrew Rosen from Hawaii State Federal Credit Union. You're listening to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. Find out more about the show at hpr2.org.
The Office of Hawaiian Affairs has its share of controversies. There are the internal struggles, the issues over self-determinism, and lawsuits involving its board members. There was a contentious election and a reorganization with a new board chair. Then this week, the board voted to buy out the 3-year contract of its CEO only 6 months after renewing it. We called board chairperson Rowena Akana to get her thoughts on Ohanau. And she was on the line up until a moment ago, and we'll get her back on the line, we hope, in just a moment. But Chris, as we look at this, we've had lots of discussions about OHA and where it's going and with how many voices go into how OHA speaks and whether those of us who are not Hawaiian should be involved. There was a lot of discussion about that over the last election, too.
Especially, it really came to the fore in the last election. Of course, in one form or another, that discussion has been going on for a while, as have several that seem to resurface each time a new board comes in. Yeah,
and this board has been reorganized, and as we see, we know what may happen with new leadership, which in fact is just a resurgence in some ways of old leadership, because Rowena Akana was, she's their oldest OHA trustee,
yeah.
Been involved since 1990. There's a lot of history and a lot of memory that gets carried with that too, and a lot of contentious issues back and forth. I understand that she's on the line with us now. Good morning, and thank you for making time for us. Are you there? Rowena Akana, are you there?
Hello
there. Oh, good. Thanks so much. We're glad to have you with us. So yesterday came word that the OHA board had voted to buy out the contract of Kamanao Crab, Pono Crab, and that was only 3 months rather. I'm sorry, 3 months into his six, the other way around, 6 months into his 3-year contract. Why get rid of him now?
Well, his contract was signed by the former chair 1 week before the election. And had the vote been taken after the election, it probably would have been 6-3. That's one thing. And another thing was that his evaluation was not good, the last evaluation. It was just barely passing. And we had a lot of resignations from employees over the past 2 years. Things internally have not been going well. And, you know, I can't say too much more because our lawyer is trying to work something out with his attorney. In the meantime, though, Mr. Crabb is being very destructive, and this is one of the reasons why we've opted to do what we're doing, because he's created an environment at OHA that has been very destructive, that we can no longer, as an agency, go on this way, because you know, the trustees make policy, and his job is to administer that policy and to make sure that the divisions within OHA follow those policies. And that has been a very difficult task for this administrator for whatever reason, and therefore making it difficult for trustees. And so, without saying too much more, it is, we feel it would be a better situation for us and cheaper in the long run to relieve him of his duties and find someone who will follow the policies of the trustees and work with us rather than against us.
How much was the issue concerning the letter asking for an opinion, from the Secretary of State on the status of the Kingdom of Hawaii? How much was that a part of what you call the destructiveness?
Oh, that's a big part. But, you know, overall, that's one of many, 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 many things. We told them at that time that, you know, this was a definite no-no, and he promised that, you know, he would not repeat this kind of behavior, but that has not been the case. And so, you know, Dr. Crabb has many good attributes. He's excellent in the health field and culture. But OHA is a huge agency now, and we look at economic development and other areas that Mr. Crabb has no expertise in. And so we just feel that it would be a better fit for us if we found someone who would fit the criteria that OHA now is going in the direction that it's going.
As you're talking about better fit, I wanted to ask you about this too, because Grassroots Institute President and CEO, now new trustee Kaylee Akina, has been critical of how OHA has been operating in past, specifically regarding Hawaiian self-determinism efforts funded through the agency. He's also the one who talked about Tuesday's vote to buy out Mr. Crabb. What do you make of Mr. Akina's or Dr. Akina's decision to say that?
Well, you know, we're all elected individually. People choose us because they like what we stand for. And while Dr. Akina has his opinions, I have mine. I think he means well. And we may differ about what is permitted under the United States Constitution. And he and I have had a talk about that. But I really believe that his heart is in the right place as far as doing things for Hawaiians and using our resources for housing and health and things that our people need. There's no doubt in my mind that under the United States Constitution, Native people are allowed to form a government within the government as long as it's within the United States. There are 500 American Indians who have nations within a nation. The Alaska Natives also have that. Hawaiians are the only ones that don't have such a nation. But that aside, Mr. Akina really means well, and I think that he's right on about the accountability that OHA needs to have with respect to the spending of money.
Let me ask you about this just in the interest of time, because I know we're going to have to leave you shortly. You've had a long history with OHA when you were first elected in 1990, and now you're the board chair once again. At the investiture ceremony, you said that OHA had lost its focus on the real purpose of what a trust is. What is that real purpose?
Yes. That real purpose is to serve the people. It is to better conditions of Native Hawaiians. And to me, that means that when you better conditions of Native Hawaiians, you help them to become better citizens, able to sustain themselves. For instance, our scholarships should not only be for academia. Not everyone is college bound. We need to also help those who want to go into trades. Call a plumber and see how much it costs you. Call an electrician, see how much it costs you.
I understand. But I wanted to ask you, with so much controversy swirling around OHA, how do you intend to keep all those internal issues from hindering the purposes that you've just talked about, or influencing how the legislature views a request for more money in the upcoming session?
Well, there's no question that it's going to be very difficult. It would be impossible for me to say, it's going to be fine. It's going to be very rocky before it gets fine. It's been years of complacency, years, 14 at least, with the last three chairmen who've allowed things to go the other way, to pay other people to do what we're supposed to be doing and watching over our monies and those kinds of things. So to correct those things overnight is monumental. It's like, I don't want to compare myself to the president, but when President Obama took the presidency, we were in debt. The economy was down the tube. And that's kind of the way I see OHA right now. So it's going to take some time to make all of these corrections, and so it's not going to be easy. It's going to be very tough.
We have to go for the moment, but we'll look forward to talking with you in future and seeing how some of those changes and, as you say, corrections are happening. Thank you very much for the time this morning.
Well, thank you very much, and good morning and aloha to everyone who's listening. Mahalo.
Rowena Akana is the chairperson of the Office of Hawaiian Affairs. It's a position she held from 1998 to 2001 as well, and now she's OHA's longest-serving trustee since 1990.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, currently raising funds for a new kidney resource center in Kapolei and for the Senator Daniel K. Akaka Community Center, kidneyhi.org.
Beth Ann, tonight at 5 on Town Square, you're going to be talking about something that you and I talk about quite a bit, which is we're now at the point where people feel that a scientific finding is something that you get to disagree with.
Or that you should disagree with it.
Yeah.
We talk a lot about the post-truth world,
right,
and you hear that phrase coming up more and more. Well, if news is now more infotainment than fact, where does that leave science? We're going to talk about that tonight on Town Square with a couple of scientists from the UH. Dr. Mark Hickson is professor of marine biology, and Joe Mobley is a professor at the UH Manoa School of Nursing. They've been having this conversation on campus, and we thought that we should take that conversation and open it up to a lot of people and hear what they have to say about it and where we all go from this point in looking at science, especially when we talk so much about STEM education.
Yeah. Well, science has evolved methods, tried and true methods of establishing with certainty that something is or ain't true, and that all seems to have those borderlines seem to have gotten more and more vague, especially in the last just 4 or 5 years.
And some would think that maybe that is the result of some shifts in ideology, or the fact that we've had some scientific issues come up in news items where things have been disproved, or there has been a problem with how a particular study has been run. But, you know, overall, when you look at how things can be replicated and when there are peer-reviewed studies and what comes out of those and how we learn from them, or how we trust or distrust them, it all comes back to how do we really view science?
Yeah, and it's kind of a whom do you trust issue as well. Thanks a lot, Beth Ann. That's Town Square tonight at 5.
Now we're going to get back to the backyard quiz. Today we went looking for the name of a seabird that's a species of tern. Their nodding, bowing, and weaving behavior during courtship has become a staple of nature videos, and it's not a sight you're likely to forget. There are three varieties in the Hawaiian Islands, feeding on fish that they catch while diving in flight. During courtship, males will present a fish to their intended, nodding and bowing the whole time. And the bird is the seafaring no'io bird that returns to land for a storm raging at sea, according to Mary Kovena Pukui. So it's the no'io, or Hawaiian nodi tern in English. That's today's answer. And nobody knew it, so we'll just hang on to our prize, and maybe tomorrow somebody else will get it.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, hosting the annual Literacy Leadership Conference and Student Celebrations, February 6th through 9th on Kauai, Hawaii Island, and Oahu. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
Local music took on some brave new directions in the 70s and 80s, incorporating influences from all over and giving them an island twist. We started to hear new age, jazz, and soul music interpreted by a whole new family of artists, a family that producer Roger Bong, founder of the record label Aloha Got Soul, is bringing to life in a new documentary film. He's on Hawaii Island now shooting interviews for his work in progress, and he's on the phone with us. Good morning, Roger.
Good morning, Chris.
You've made it kind of your passion to rediscover the music of back in the day in Hawaii, huh?
Yeah, it's definitely a passion. You know, I work another job full time, but this is something I do on the side, and it's really opened up a whole different world of music from Hawaii for me. So,
because this is you were a kid when this music was being made, right?
I was born in 1987, actually. So
yes,
some of the artists who were making this music were doing it before my time.
Yeah, you were not yet a kid. So what drew you to it, you know? So many young people are, you know, listen to the music of other young people, right?
Right, yeah. It's curiosity, but also during the 70s and the 80s, you know, musicians were at a skill level and just a different mind state. They were creating something with their hands and with pure talent, and I think it's something that maybe kind of lacks in today's world of computers and drum machines and things like that.
Well, I came to Hawaii in 83 and started playing music here, and it was just a little bit before the drum machines and synthesizers took over. But they did kind of take over.
We met with this guy, Gary Washburn, who I believe you interviewed a few months ago, and
yeah.
He had like a 13 or 16-piece band called Just in Time.
Mm-hmm.
And it was incredible what they were doing. They had all kinds of musicians in the band playing various instruments. There was even a tuba player who played a harmonica.
Mm-hmm.
So very experimental stuff going on at the time, which we're trying to bring a new light to with this documentary film.
Well, you know, back in the 70s, you would walk into a record store and you would have a section called jazz, and you'd have a section called rock and roll, and you'd have a section called country and western, whatever that is. And there were, it's almost as if there were walls between the genres.
Right.
There wasn't much talk about world music. That category really wasn't in existence yet. And, you know, it's like, which is sort of an odd category in itself, what music is not world music, right?
Right, right. Well, the interesting thing is some of these artists who were interviewing, maybe they put a few releases out, but they never, you know, reached a level of, I don't know, reputation or reach that got their name out there even further than I think they deserve. For example, there's a flute player and synthesizer, I guess composer, named Robert Aeolus Myers, mm-hmm. who lived here in the early 80s through the early 90s. And he released some stuff on cassette, and I guess you could describe it as world music. You could also call it new age music,
yeah.
or ambient electronic, and he did a lot of interesting stuff. But we did an interview last week with him over Skype. He's on the East Coast now, and I asked him, where does your music fit in the music of Hawaii? And he said, I was just a footnote.
Well, that's an interesting comment, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, because, you know, some of the people we're talking with, they were kind of blazing their own trail, I guess you could say.
Well, in some ways, I think that the music world opened up to being able to do that. It was starting to reach the point where we're starting to get to the point where you could record yourself. More and more people like, you know, Stevie Wonder kind of led the way in making records where he played all the instruments and wrote all the songs and did it exactly the way he wanted to. And that inspired a lot of people, I think.
Yeah, I agree. And the thing that we're learning about Hawaii, and as we're going along with this documentary, is that, you know, Hawaii is just, of course, we know it's just such an open place and accepting of everybody and everything. And I think a lot of that aloha spirit plays into the way musicians embrace other sounds or are willing to experiment with something new or something different.
So you're seeing a kind of an infusion of the local spirit to the broader world of music, yeah?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we have all kinds of people in these islands and all kinds of musicians that we're talking with. But the one thing that remains true is just their respect for other people and other things and willingness to live in harmony, no matter how they do that. So,
and a lot of people came to Hawaii sort of to get away from rat races of one kind or another, especially in the world of music. I think we got a lot of imports in those decades for just
yeah,
that
absolutely.
Very reason.
And I think it also influenced people who were born and raised here. In about an hour or so, we're going to meet with a harpist. Her name is Momi Riley, and she lives in Pahoa.
Mm-hmm.
She did two albums in, I believe it's the early 80s, that incorporate all sorts of interesting imports, as you might call it. Rock, jazz, a little bit of reggae, a little bit of soul, and I'm really looking forward to meeting her for the first time. We've been talking for a while now through Facebook and whatnot, but we're going to be meeting for the first time later today.
Are the people you've been talking to pretty excited about, you know, getting some renewed recognition through this project?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, for some musicians, their careers have been going on, so, you know, the stuff that I'm asking them about that they did 30 or 40 years ago, maybe that's, you know, in the past. But for other people, for other musicians, you know, some of the music they put out was the only music they put out during that time and ever, I guess you could say. And so this is kind of it's a reigniting a certain flame or a spark or, you know, something's happening when us young folk go and talk to these people who, you know, were living their lives to the fullest when they made this music in the 70s and the 80s and whatnot.
Well, it's most welcome, Roger. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for your interest.
Roger Bong is a co-producer of the Aloha Got Soul documentary film, which will have a preview screening Saturday, January 14th at 7 p.m. at the Surf Shack Hotel in Waikiki.
everything I have in your life, and I really understand you. You're like we are alive, breathing in this heart. I am in you. You're like, ooh, whoa, whoa, whoa.
Beth Ann, it would seem that OHA's reputation for internal contentiousness, if you will, is not going to go away anytime soon.
Well, clearly to hear what Rowena Akana said earlier, that her ideas and how it needs to get fixed, and she pointed to a 14-year history in her mind of how things have gone south and having to look for a new CEO if, in fact, CEO Crabb decides to go along with the buyout. You know, who knows what may come out of that. But clearly, looking at, as she said, a very rocky future.
Yeah, certainly looks that way.
But for us, it's hopefully going to be a little smoother, because we'll come back with you tomorrow morning and take a look at the Hamakua Community Development Plan.
And we'll get a studio visit from an Americana band called Discord and Rye.
That should be fun. And meanwhile, we'd like to hear from you, and we've got a talk back line that's available 24/7, so just call us at 808-792-8217 if you like. Just be sure to leave us your name and the town from which you're calling, or if you like, email. That's available too at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
If you missed any of this show or want to hear a past show, you can find them all on the conversation page, along with links to information about guests and topics you hear on the show. Just look under Talk Shows for the Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you in the morning with more of The Conversation.